You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. As we reach the 150th episode, it's a long overdue return to investigator and author Paul Sinclair. Despite the challenges we've all faced over the last 18 months, Paul has continued to keep chasing down leads and interviewing witnesses for both of his upcoming releases, the fourth volume of Truth Proof and his cryptid documentary, Wolflands. Paul brings us up to date, with plenty of strange incidents being uncovered, as well as discussing my recent visit to join him out on the cliffs. A big thank you to Paul for joining me on my 150th episode. Before we get there, as always, you can support the show by signing up for Patreon for $4 a month for ad-free episodes, early releases, and much more. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can find Mysteries and Monsters merchandise through our website, mysteriesandmonsters.com. by using the tabs at the top of the page. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his artwork, to Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys for his production duties, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Just before we join Paul, I just wanted to say thank you one and all for your continued support over my previous 149 episodes, and here's to the next 150. Now, let's travel to the east coast of England, in the company of Paul Sinclair. As I hit the big 150th episode, who better to join me than one of my most popular previous guests from the three appearances he's made so far on Mysteries and Monsters, Mr. Paul Sinclair. Fresh from taking me out onto the cliffs at Benton, Paul's looking forward to both the release of his fourth volume of Truth Proof alongside his upcoming documentary, Wolflands. Paul, welcome back, sir.
And thank you very much for having me back, Paul. It's a pleasure, to be honest. And it was good to meet you last week up at Bempton with your good lady. You know, we passed a few hours on, didn't we?
We did. It was lovely, Paul. And I have to say, it was really nice to finally come over and spend a couple of hours with you in that area and for you and Bob to take the time to take me round and show me the sights and give me some background to everything. It gives it a real bit of depth, I suppose, because when you're there, obviously you can kind of get a real feel for what's been going on. So I really do appreciate the time, my friend.
Oh, you're welcome. And, you know, that's something a lot of people have said, you know, when they've read the books. And I don't want to say that people specifically visit area because of the books, but they can relate to the places. I don't know. You drive between Bridlington and Scarborough and you're passing Filey. If you've never been before, you think, oh, that's the place. Maybe have a run round at Humanby, Farmstead of the Hound Man, you know, and all these places that it sort of brings them to life a little bit more. It animates things. And as I say, I know you had a few days in area, and it were good to meet up. It's a shame nothing occurred, but as you know, that's the nature of unexplained phenomena. It just sort of pops up and shocks us when we least expect it.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I would have been a bit, I don't know what I'd have done, Paul, if something would have happened, but I mean, that's the thing about unexplained phenomena. You can't set your watch to it. So I wasn't surprised. It's disappointing, but you know, I'll certainly be coming back if you're happy to have me again, my friend.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm sure. You know, I mean, look at what me and Bob Brown sort of spends most of the time up there with me. I am going tonight, but Bob won't be coming. But he's got work in the morning, I think. But look at how long we go up there. You know, we've been up for the last probably 3 or 4 months, nothing. Yeah. I know that lights were seen from a boat in Arbor that went out into Bay. That'll be probably going back 4 or 5 weeks now. They've reported seeing two of these orange spheres. But other than that, there's not been a lot. There have been UFO reports out of the area and things happening. I got an interesting one from a place called Bythorn.
Yeah.
From a farmer. And you'll have to Google Bythorn, people, because I'm not that familiar with the area myself. But and that he were off to do a bit of what would they call it? Pest control. Yeah.
Yeah.
He previously worked on one of these fields during the daytime. I think they'd cut the crop, so it were all down to stubble. And I think he said it were 90-acre area. I ain't got information in front of me, so if I've said 85 in some way, like, I'm not lying, it's just the way of things. But I think he said it were 90-acre. Talking to his friend on the phone, it's getting towards dusk, and he just turned round and looked across at the field, and in the middle of the field, there's a huge column of light. So he's about a quarter of a mile away, and he can't believe what he's looking at. And as luck would have it, he snapped a photograph. He'd got phone at hand and got one before it departed, which we put on the truthproof.uk website. His description is really good, because he said, I had a thermal camera, so I'll tell you how it left in a moment. He said, so, but when it disappeared, I put the thermal on. He says it could pick out a mouse at quarter of a mile. And I know he's right, because that one of mine could. And there's nobody. There's no heat signature. There's nothing at all in the field. And this thing's in the middle of the field on an elevation, and you can see behind it. So we're ruling out a human presence, should we say, somebody with a powerful lamp.
Yeah.
Because the interesting part of it, Paul, he said when the light disappeared, it didn't just switch off instantly. He said it was, he said, if you could imagine being on top of a tube of light and putting your hand on top of it and just pushing it into the earth, he says that's how it went away. So it retracted. So that's another good analogy for anybody that thinks, well, I probably searchlight from a dragon light from a police helicopter.
Yeah.
But this thing didn't. It went back into the earth. It's really, I won't say shocked him, but it's made him think. He said, I were only working on the field that day. He's since been back, obviously. I asked him if he could go back, see if there's any trace of anything. And he's not found anything at all. But just an interesting sighting. And, you know, obviously the stuff that I look into Eastern North Yorkshire, it's growing. You know, it's going out to area any road. And like I've said before, Paul, if somebody comes with a brilliant account, no matter what it is, if it's slightly strange and quirky, then I'll look into it, providing it seems legitimate, should we say.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, what I found fascinating and also very reassuring, Paul, was the fact that I was there with you for as we said, a good couple of hours, and we were there at dusk, watched the sunset, and it's a stunningly beautiful place.
Yeah.
The whole scenery and the sea lapping against the cliffs and everything, it's beautiful. And what really struck me was, obviously, I'm sort of saying, me and my partner are going, oh, what's this? What's that? You and Bob know that area now like the back of your hands. So you were saying, oh, there, that's a ship. That's some kind of rig. That's a light. That's a satellite. I mean, for me, that just gives everything else that you guys have been doing so much more credence, because often, Paul, people say, oh, you just don't know what you're looking at. You're misunderstanding the normal sights and things like that.
Yep. You're absolutely spot on. You know, I mean, and I don't mean we're absolute experts, but we do know the area. There were some strange orange, I'll get back to what you're saying in a moment, because this ties in. There were some strange orange lights at the back of the old RAF base a few years ago. I was Steve Ashbridge. I'm probably talking 2016. And I think I put a little clip of them on the Truth Proof YouTube channel. They're nothing spectacular. It's just a strange flaring up of orange light behind the base. Now, it's, it could be something man-made. Most people don't have an orange torch. And in late hours, I don't know what they'd be doing with an orange torch. I could think of a red infrared light if they wanted to be poaching or something. But this one orange and it was flashing up. My point is, you get experts on YouTube who know better than people who filmed it. And he's saying to me, well, it's lighthouse. And there's a few disrespectful words and swear words telling me it's lighthouse. And he's putting his point over. I don't think I even replied.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at comments on this bit of footage, I'm sure I didn't. But if I had replied, I'd have said, well, if you knew the layout of the land, you would see that the lighthouse was behind me. Yeah. And you could take it. I were actually facing away from lighthouse. But for anybody who doesn't know and they listen to them comments, they check on board, they think, well, it's probably right. And this guy's, it's lighthouse in like a funny kind of misty weather condition flashing behind the buildings. You don't see lighthouse from when you're looking towards the RAF buildings. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But so, yeah, we look out the boats out of sea. We know roughly what elevation we've got, you know, 200 foot, and we might be looking, I don't know, 15 miles 18 miles, you start rising in elevation and you can go up to 22 miles that you can see on horizon.
Mm.
And there's all sorts of things that you could fool somebody if you wanted, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a bit of mist out at sea and it's low-lying mist and it's a proper long light blanket in a line, then you could think that were the horizon. This is what I'm saying. Mm. So you could see lights behind it from boats and think that's a UFO or an unidentified light, should we say.
Yeah.
And it's not. The horizon is actually behind the mist, but it's difficult. You really do have to spend a bit of time up there to know what's about. There's a few rigs out there and they burn off gas odd times, so you get a big sort of yellow flame that at a distance looks unusual.
Yeah.
And like you said, you've got the lighthouse and the satellites. I mean, last night the space station passed over.
Mm.
Oh, they're trying to pretend that it's anything else. It was space station. You know, and you get your satellites that flare up, the iridium flares and things. I mean, it's easy to misidentify things, but it's you actually do know when you're looking at something that's just not quite right, and especially if it's close up. And I always cite this Lee Hayward sighting. I call it that because Lee was with me.
Hmm.
But where we stood a few weeks ago with you and your lady, the field between us, I told you that's where this alleged flying saucer landed on the hillside.
Yeah.
And it were in the field between us and this landing of 1998. And this is only in 2019 that we saw this.
Mm.
And I feel sure that it was just because Lee had gone up, you know, with me to disprove what I were looking at, because he's a really switched on kind of guy. And I don't mind anybody trying to disprove anything. That's the full nature of what we should be looking into.
Yeah.
We should be questioning it and looking if we can find a logical answer. I just like the way some people approach it, and Lee does it in a respectful manner. But he wanted to try and disprove it, but he came away totally confused and baffled by what he'd seen, because it was just a huge orange sphere with three spheres within it glowing in the field. And I mean, huge.
Yeah.
And you know, you're not looking at anything when it's hundreds of yards away, not miles away. You know, you're not looking at anything that anybody knows what it is. If you know what it's, there's no feasible explanation. As fast as I was banging the camera around and trying to get it on, it imploded and it had gone, but it was huge.
Mm.
So yeah, that's probably a bit off track there, Paul, but you know, it's just misidentification. I don't know. Of course it does happen. I mean, last night we were up there and we saw unusual lights, first time in months and months. You know, I spoke to Chris Turner, last week, and I know they'd been to Cannock Chase.
Yeah.
I think Chris, Mark Farnell, I don't know who else. Oh, Jerry Denning.
Yep.
And what I like about it is that you hear of people going and they have an experience. They see something or they hear something and it became terrifying. Chris saw nothing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Nobody experienced anything. And it makes you wonder sometimes if people just sort of generate a bit of fear and imagine the things. I don't mean it's not there. I don't mean there's no activity at Cannock. There is.
Mm.
But you hear a lot of people going, and on that night they go, they have an experience. We've gone up to them cliff tops at Bempton for months and months,
yeah,
religiously, and seen nothing until last night.
Yeah,
you know, you went up, nothing.
Yeah,
it's just the way of it, and it wouldn't be unexplained phenomena. It wouldn't be half as interesting if every night somebody went up they saw something unusual, would it?
No, exactly. That's the thing, isn't it?
yeah, it's just how it is, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I was just really impressed with the way you and Bob work, and what you very kindly showed us some of your tech and how it works and what you do. And obviously Bob and my partner he was showing off his laser pens and all that kind of thing, and just giving us a real breakdown of it. And as you say, I suppose it's very easy if you've never been there to go, well, it's this and it's that and it's this. But as we were there, Paul, I mean, I know that area.
Yeah.
Quite well anyway, but obviously it's the first time I've had the opportunity to spend some time with you out in the field. And I remember when the sun was setting and the lighthouse started, first couple of times I saw it, I was like, oh, what's that? And then I thought, of course, it's Flamborough. It's the lighthouse. Yeah. It's obvious. So when somebody criticises you and says, oh, well, you've got it wrong. Well, I've been there. So I know where the lighthouse is compared to where the farmhouse is and the RAF base, Paul. I know where that is now.
It's almost like, I don't think they're even criticising you. I think that sometimes people just want to be clever for the sake of being clever.
Mm.
You know, and I don't, obviously, they've never, if they got off their armchair or the computer stool, got from behind it and actually went to these places, they would know. I think people imagine, because there's four books now, yeah. You know, other ones just about done, you know, all on reports just about from the immediate area, Eastern North Yorkshire, that things are happening every time you go up.
Yeah.
But they're not. These are the decades and decades of reports from independent people, not just myself. Most of reports within those books, I would think 99% of them are from other people.
Yeah.
But they're not my own, despite the fact that I go up there a lot of times, and you know, it is basically the luck of the draw. I mean, when you went up there, Bob had got his tri-field meter, and you know, it's not something that I've really looked into. It's a decent bit of kit. It's not something you could buy off eBay, say, for £10. It's we're talking hundreds of pounds, and there shouldn't be any electromagnetic activity up there or any microwave readings up there. So removing phones from pockets and putting them in camera bags and walking up without anything to hinder this little device. And it's literally, it's buzzing off the scale.
Yeah.
Not every night, but you'll get it one night out of the middle of nowhere. We don't know what's causing these anomalies. I went up 2 weeks ago, myself, Bob, we went in the daytime, early morning. With a guy called Peter Masters, electronics guy.
Mm.
And he'd built an antenna to pick up different energies, different electrical energies. And he'd also got a bit of kit looking for microwave energies. It was a microwave testing device, actually.
Yeah.
So we've got this antenna, which is omnidirectional, and we picked this huge band of energy up just at back at old RAF base that shouldn't have been coming from anywhere in particular. There shouldn't have been anything there. And yeah, I filmed it. We, you know, it was a solid sort of band of energy that we've got going up. We're going to do more work on this. There's more to do. It was the kit that Peter were using, the antenna he'd built himself, because it, you know, bit quite sophisticated bit of kit. I mean, I need to say that this guy's got PhDs and worked with turbines and with Faraday cages. He kind of knows his stuff.
Yeah.
So we thought there's a base at Speeton, which is about 2 to 3 miles away from the old disused RAF base at Bempton. It runs in line with the RAF Staxton Wold. And we thought it's something that's kicking out from that base. That's the initial thought. So we jumped in the car, drove probably a mile and a half, parked at Speeton Church, which is then quite close to the base, put the equipment on. It's weaker. The signal's weaker. So we ruled that out. So God knows where it were coming from. And I mean, another strange thing, and this has happened with a lot of people with electrical devices, including mobile phones. He took his laptop up there with 100% charge. He said, depending on his usage, 2 to 3 hours he gets out of it, the battery. 20 minutes of testing at Bempton, and it were reading, I'm not certain, people, if it were 42 or 48%. It were one of them two. God knows why, I can't remember exact one, but it were one of them two. And he said, that's not happened before. Well, that happened with all Andrew Collins' equipment when he went up there. It's happened with my camera batteries, the Pulsar thermal camera. Amanda, a friend of ours who goes up there, she's got one. And them batteries are the probably most powerful batteries on a device of that type that you could get. They'll last 4 to 9 hours.
Yeah.
Depending on whether, and hers drained. Steve Ashbridge's thermal camera drained. So what am I getting at? We go back to we're at 42 to 48% at Bempton, and we drive to Speeton. So a journey of 15 minutes, probably a 20 bit time. We've walked back from the old RAF base to the car and then drove to Speeton, 25 minutes maybe.
Yeah.
Set the equipment up. His battery's at 77%. Now, I don't know how that works. And I need to stress that it's not like somebody who's got a torch and the batteries go and you turn it off for 10 minutes, then put it back on and you've got a bit of light until they just drain down. It stayed in the 70s all the time we worked on testing these strange signals and the microwave emissions, yes, which there was nothing actually being emitted at microwave type of emissions up at Speighton, but we got it on the cliff tops at Bempton. We haven't got enough knowledge to say, we haven't done enough work to categorically say what's happening up there at the moment. But I need to add that it's also been on the news, BBC News, yesterday, one day before, that hundreds and hundreds of seabirds are dying up at Bempton.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that, Paul, did you?
I did, yeah, actually. Well, whenever I see anything like that, I just think immediately, I think of you. Not that I think you're responsible, Paul, obviously. But, you
I'm
know,
not
anything
doing
that...
Let me catapult. No. But, yeah. You know, obviously, I think we're talking about up and down the coast, so we don't really need to just localise it and centre on Bempton, but that particular place did figure in the news report. But sometimes the RSPB staff maybe don't get onto the clifftops into the places that I go. I mean, and I get a lot further up the coast past the bird sanctuary. And I've, on numerous occasions during the summer months over the years, I've found lots and lots of gannets dead.
Yeah, and
I think I wrote about it, and well, I know I've written about it, and I know I've spoken about it on radio. That I think it was 2017 when I went up there, and there were bees dead everywhere. You know, bumblebees, loads of different species of them. And I don't just mean, oh, look, there's a bee, and I'll walk for 10 minutes to find another. They were everywhere, all over the path, like plagues of bloody bees, and they were dead and dying.
Yes.
So I don't. You'd think to yourself, well, could it be some kind of fertilizer off fields? We've got North Sea 20 foot away.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, it's difficult to say. And that was the same day that my wife got an electric shock off the fence that weren't electrified.
Yeah.
And that happened twice. And it stopped to watch. You know, it's a weird place when it wants to be. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about it. I suppose that's half the mystery, Paul, is that it's so inconsistent that it doesn't respond to people going up there all the time. As with any kind of mysterious phenomenon, wherever you are in the world and in certain areas like this, I think the fact that it isn't omnipresent, it doesn't always happen, gives it a lot more credence in regards to the fact that it just proves that wherever it is, it's not tangible, it's not a constant thing, it's not some kind of geological formation, it's not some kind of signal that's permanently there, Paul. It seems to come and go as it pleases.
Well, you know, the actual geology of the land, it's chalk.
Mm.
There's no granite or anything, you know, and so we shouldn't be getting the readings that we've been getting off these things testing the electromagnetic radiation and the other things. We shouldn't be getting anything.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really think that the tri-field meter should be going off the scale, screaming its head off.
Yeah.
Walking up the cliff top and then walking up the same bit of cliff top the following night or two nights later, and it's just ticking and nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, why is it different one night to another? Why does the phenomena appear to move about? I think we have identified an area where it seems a little bit more concentrated.
Mm.
And we were stood near it when I was with you, the other night, the other week, should I say. And it turns out, but it's took years to sort of, I wouldn't say come to fruition, but to realize it, you know, obviously this fisherman who saw this perceived spaceship in 1998 and the other fisherman, there were more than one rock angler saw it.
Mm.
You know, the strange square of light that Gemma and my daughter Gemma and Bob saw last year in the same area, it was just there in the torch beams, dropped at floor and disappeared. He's had some strange photographs from there, Bob, that we can't explain.
Yeah.
Daylight photograph. I don't know if they showed it you.
Yes, he showed me the strange shape on the hillside. That is just a very odd photo, Paul.
Well, how it came about, he was taking a picture of a kestrel.
Mm.
Hovering. I'd got a camera set up on sea. They'd just cut the crop and it was last year. So we'd, you know, a couple of weeks ago, give or take a week from where we are now. And I saw him looking at his camera and looking a bit confused. And I said, what's the matter? He says, I'm just taking a picture of that bird. He said, and this big dark shape appeared on that hill, 400 yards away approximately. And I looked at his picture and sure enough, it were there. And I went straight up there with my daughter, Gemma. There's only fields at the back. There was nothing at all there. And it is odd. It's almost like a huge creature sort of crouched or I don't know, like a... Or you can see that, like the shape of shoulders and head. And you know, we know we get the pareidolia and things, but
yeah,
I think the main thing to stress is it wasn't there. He got it in a photograph, and it just wasn't there anymore. So it's an interesting place, and there's that many people experienced things, and you've got that many people coming at you from all angles. It's so varied, the actual things that are being seen and the cryptid sightings, Paul, you know?
Yeah.
I found out from a former lifeboat man via a text, but we're friends anyway, so we speak quite often. And I spoke to his brother. They were at a Leeds match last week.
Yeah.
With a Flamborough man.
Mm.
And they must have got on about the unexplained phenomena and the strange things. And he said that he got followed home on foot by a huge black dog, he said, but it didn't look like it was solid. It almost looked like a dark see-through shadow of a dog, he said, but it was huge.
Yeah.
And but he didn't feel frightened. Will he speak to Paul? No.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He won't speak. Like yesterday, this guy might listen because he's very interested. My good friend Chris Wright, it's not Chris that we're on about here, but he was up working around the forests of North Yorkshire.
Yeah.
He connects internet and does people's phones. And he went in there and he rang me up and he said, I've got a guy who wants to talk to you. He says, be a really good contact, I think. So I rang this guy up later in the evening. Then I spoke to him again today. Really interesting man. He seems keen to talk, but he won't go on camera.
Yeah.
His cottage is in the heart of the forest.
Oh.
And I'll not say which forest it is. I mean, I've said to him, could we film you from behind looking into the forest, just telling us what you've experienced? I'd rather not. I know gamekeepers around here. I'm good friends with them. I know some of the farmers, the adjoining farms, and I'd just rather not. So yes, that's fair. We've got to respect that. And he's not seen anything. So your listeners now will be going, what's Paul on about? Well, he's heard something. So he said in the years that he's lived there, he's been woken up on a few occasions. I don't mean every night, every week, every month, on a few occasions. And he's had to go downstairs and open the door and listen, because I don't think it matters whether he opened his back door or his front door. It's in the middle of the forest.
Hmm.
He said, if you'd said to me there's a pride of lions in the forest, I would have believed you. He says, because that's what it sounds like.
Oh.
Seriously, he said, a pride of lions. Now, remember, he lives in a remote forest, and a big forest, not a little woodland.
Hmm.
So what I'm trying to stress is he's heard foxes, he's heard deers rutting, he's heard deers barking.
Yeah.
And did I say deers? Deer. it's like saying sheeps.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's heard all these things. He said, this is like nothing I've heard. He said, it sounds like the forest is being tore to bits. He said, and his exact words, a pride of lions. And I'd have liked to have got that on camera with a guy looking into the forest telling us this. In view of the gamekeeper's story that's already on Wolfland.
Yep.
Because it's very close. It's within a mile of where he saw it. You know, and it's fascinating. So you've got these stories, and I don't think there's any end to them. I believe that there's people out there sat on stories far more interesting than mine, what I talked about in Night People, far more interesting than these guys in the forests.
Mm.
But they sat on them for a reason.
Yeah.
It's frightening stuff. A lot of this is frightening. There's no love and light in the night, not in these areas anyway.
Yeah, very true. I find it very interesting as well, Paul, because obviously since we've got to know each other, I've found myself drawn to this area anyway. Especially over the last 12 months, I've been up to Northumberland and gone through the Yorkshire Dales and driven through some of these areas where people are having weird experiences with strange cryptids. And when you go in these areas, I think one of these things we have about this country is that often we forget how remote certain places are. And the North Yorkshire Moors is a prime example. The area around where Bempton is, yes, you've got the, you know, you've got Flamborough and Bridlington sort of straddling it. But there's nothing else around there. You know, it's farmland at the back. You've got the North Sea to the front. There is nowhere for you to go. It's a very ominous place. And obviously the day after, we'd spent some time with you and we were coming back to Sheffield. And I was saying we were going to visit Rudston and see the monolith, because I've always wanted to see that. And when you stand there, Paul, in that churchyard next to this enormous stone that's been there for the best part of 4,000 years, they think.
Yeah.
What struck me about that is it's on this little mound, and everywhere around you, you're basically in the dip of a valley, but you're on a mound in Rudston, this little village, in the middle of nowhere, where you've got probably within a complete circle of about 10 miles around you, where you can see down onto this stone. And when you see these kind of areas, Paul, you think, well, obviously the thing about this monolith is that they've dragged it from Whitby as well, yeah, to where it is, which is about 10 miles away.
It's potentially been dragged from Whitby. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not saying, and it could have been, but there's a similar stone, the grit stone, in Cornelian Bay, which, you know, Whitby is even further up, but that you can,
yes.
And Caton Bay's got that stone, and there's a suggestion that it's come on a glacial ice flow.
Mm.
Do you know, but the main thing, and the thing you're getting at, is that somebody with limited tools and limited experience of engineering, although you can't say that because it stood up 4,000 years,
yeah,
has erected this stone long before the church.
Yeah.
Long before the church was there. You know, the Rudston Monolith is allegedly runs on a ley line that passes through one of the most important burial mounds regarding folklore in England, if not the world, which is Willie Howe.
Yes.
And that's probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles away.
Yes.
And then it goes on to Stackstone Wold, where the RAF base is. But before Stackstone Wold was there, it was a Roman hill fort.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, that don't mean it's some mystical place. It was probably a Roman hill fort because it's 500 foot above sea level and they can see what's coming. You know what I mean?
That, yeah.
Obviously, that's got to be part of the reason. But it's interesting. And for anybody who's never done dowsing, and I'm not that familiar with it, me and my wife made some rods. And we went round Willie Howe one summer, and we spent a few hours there. It works. Whatever energies are there, it works. And these things turned in under their own steam, and we pegged it out. It were like an hot cross bun.
Yes.
You know, there were four lines, and I can't say without getting above the burial mound whether it were in a perfect cross in the middle, but there were four lines, almost like a cross coming through it.
Mm.
But getting back to the Rudston Monolith, it were excavated in the 1800s by William Strickland.
Mm.
William Strickland, I think, I might have got my facts wrong here. He was at Boynton Hall. And have I got this right? Or it weren't Sledmere. It were Boynton Hall. Boynton, their family crest is a turkey, because they're the reason you've got Christmas, a turkey at Christmas, because they're responsible for bringing turkeys into the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Not that that means to do with paranormal interests, but there you go. But anyway, William Strickland excavated it in the 1800s, and he found a large quantity of human skulls beneath the ground that he dug up. So he speculated, and the sort of people helping him at the time, that there'd been human sacrifice on the site as well. He also noted that there was as much stone below ground as what there was above.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because I think we're looking at about 27 to 28 feet above ground.
Yeah, it's massive.
So it's a monstrous piece of work and architecture for people of 4,000 years ago to, if they did drag it, to actually erect it and get it in position.
Yeah.
You know, it's just incredible. And one story I got from there, I don't know, when you went there, did you notice the offerings around it? Were there any?
I was just about to say, that struck me as a very interesting aspect, that people are still visiting this place and leaving little gifts, Paul.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And I mean, I've never taken any away, but there's little crystals and flowers and things of sentimental value. Obviously, the people at the church must remove them quite often because there always seems to be different ones there when I go. Unless you went next day, of course.
Mm.
And it's interesting that people are still treating it with a lot of kind of reverence. I were told by two young men that went to visit it during the night years ago. We're going back to 2000s, that they saw a black cat in the grounds of the Rudston Church. I don't know, and I'm not saying it's attached to the monolith, but it dropped out of a tree, as in jumped down. Yeah, so that quite frightened them. There's no other tales to tell me. I mean, there are a few things from Rudston from years ago, if I sort of cast my mind back. One of our daughters was engaged to somebody whose dad owned a farm at Rudston. That's best thing, easiest way to say it. And I got to see a crop circle.
Yeah.
That nobody else got to see, which I found fascinating.
Yeah.
Just a circle about 60 foot round, which made me think that I were looking at the real deal because nobody else got to see it.
Mm.
This thing just appeared. They didn't want the land turning into a thoroughfare. And I were quite heavily involved in subject to researching UFOs at the time, even if I weren't being vocal about it. You know, I were up on walls all the time, you know.
Mm.
So these things happen. I mean, I'll give you an interesting story about the farmhouse. My daughter and her boyfriend were in bed one night there, very old farmhouse, and she's not really got lots of stories. I mean, night people, we'll jump to this story in a minute. My night people's about my experiences and the experiences of my immediate family. But Jess, you'll not mind me mentioning her name, she's not got lots to tell, and she's not really that interested in the subject.
Yeah.
So where am I going? She told me this story. She's laid in bed. Her boyfriend, I'll not say his name, was asleep. She woke up in the night, and there's a wooden chest. I can picture it now because I went into the room, and there's a wooden chest at the bottom of the bed. And then at the bottom of the bed, there's two dark figures in robes stood. The room's slightly illuminated, and she said there's a conical-shaped jar on the wooden chest, like you'd have in a science lab.
Yes.
And it's full of luminous green liquid. This is what she's telling me.
Yeah.
I don't know if she said they were pouring something into it or pouring something out of it, and there was a little person in a robe.
Hmm.
And she's watching this, frightened her to death. She said the little one turned. She couldn't see her face and looked at her. Even though she couldn't see her face, you know it's looking at her. So I closed my eyes and didn't look and sort of turned to one side. And she said, and when I looked again, it was stood outside at bed.
No.
Outside of me. She said, and then I closed my eyes tight again. And next thing, it's morning. No abduction scenario or anything like that here, people.
Yeah.
You know, we've got no memories of anything like that. But that's just, I don't think I've ever even told anybody that story before.
Mm.
And I know I've not written about it, but that happened to Jess, and I've no reason to disbelieve her. You know, I'm trying to think of other things that have happened with members of my family, and there's not loads because I think if it were happening all the time, Paul, you would be all sort of raising his eyebrows and thinking, oh, this is a bit too convenient. This guy's gone to Bempton and seen something again.
Yeah.
There's hundreds of bird spotters go up to Bempton every day at week in summer. Why aren't they seeing things?
Yeah.
How come it's only this fella? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they make a good point. But what they don't know is there are bird spotters that do see things and have reported them to me. And there's bird spotters that have reported them to the RSPB because I were doing some work on the actual building many years ago, probably 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
So a member of staff had to stay with us all night while we were doing this work. And he was telling me then that people have come in and said they've seen unusual things out at sea and above them on, you know, while they've been on the cliff tops. So it's not unique. It is there. It does get reported. I mean, the ex-South African military guy, I can't think of his name. He lives at Burton Fleming. So if you're listening to this, Robert, I know they call him Robert, actually. If you listen to this, Robert, I'm sorry, I forgot your surname. But he went up there with his wife on a bright summer's day. Loads of people on clifftops looking at seabirds.
Hmm.
You know, so anybody that's not familiar who's listening to the podcast, it's probably one of the biggest gannet, you know, the seabird colonies in England.
Yeah.
And they get puffins and razorbills and all sorts of birds. At the moment, there's a albatross there.
Yes.
Which is way off course for where it should be. But so obviously it attracts a lot of attention. But jumping back to this guy, bright summer's day, ex-military, so familiar with what should and shouldn't be in the sky, should we say.
Hmm.
So he's walking down, he says, and he looks at the old RAF base, and we're not talking hundreds of feet. He says, like 50 to 100 foot above one of these old buildings, there's a huge oval or lozenger-shaped object. That's the best he could say. So it's huge, bigger than the building.
Yeah.
So he's looking at it and can't work. He says, he thought, first of all, he says, I thought somebody had tethered a barrage balloon to the top. And he said, I'm looking at it, trying to point it out to people. No, but it's like nobody's looking at us.
Mm.
He said, so me and my wife are looking at this thing, and we decide to go up the side of the RAF base, not on the land, up the side, to get a closer look. And we're watching it all the time, and I'm trying to beckon people, pointing, look at this, but nobody's looking at us. He said, and then we took his eyes off it for a few moments, probably to try and say, whoa, look at this, what's this? When we look back, he said, it's turned white, brilliant white. He said, and we're carrying on looking at it, we keep walking. Look away again or look down, I don't know what. He said, and look again, it's gone. So, you know, these things are being seen, these unusual, what would we call them? I don't know. Is it a UFO? It's clearly not coming from space, whatever it is, because it's already here.
Mm.
But just an interesting sort kind of sighting. There were another one from years ago, a guy called David Ellis who lives in Bempton.
Yeah.
He had two Labrador dogs, so he'd walk up Bempton, up Cliff Lane,
yeah,
and most evenings after work, and take his dogs for a walk. Now, when you get to the car park, there's an entrance out onto the cliff tops, a single gate, but at the other side of the car park, there's a double gate, a 5-bar gate, you know, like they'd have in a farmer's field.
Yeah.
Now it says no entry, strictly no entry, but back then, you could go through that gate. And he went through the gate and walked down the field with his dogs. He said, and he was watching a barn owl skimming about hunting in summer's evening. And then he looks onto the cliff tops and he sees a cloud of blue. It's a day like this, like a blue cloud. He says, like a defined dome shape, but it just looked like mist.
Mm.
And you could see it hung over the cliff as well. He said, and inside it, and this is on the path then, so it would have been on the cliff path, over the cliffs, out to sea and over onto the field. He says, and inside it, though, it were almost like lights punching out, like explosions of light inside this luminous sphere of blue light.
Yeah.
And it didn't bother his dogs. His dogs carried on milling about. He said he watched it for a while and obviously then went home. Now, it kind of makes you wonder, anybody on clifftops walking, if they'd have encountered that, I mean, what would happen if you walked through it?
Yeah.
I think I'd try and avoid it and walk around it. Well, just another quirky thing. I mean, another Bempton man, and I've not written about the story I've just told you, I'm pretty sure, unless I did put it in first book, but this one I've written about, and this is the guy who used to walk Cliff Lane religiously, depending on shifts, either every evening or every morning.
Yeah.
And he'd done it for 20-odd years. And he's had three events from 7 days a week in 20-odd years. So you can see how sparse this is and how sort of rare a phenomena it is.
Hmm.
But on this occasion, he said that he's walking there, gets to the top of Cliff Lane, looking over onto the old RAF base. What does he see? Like a mushroom-shaped cloud of sparkling blue light with lights flashing inside it. Now, He doesn't know this guy, David Ellis. He doesn't know him. You know what I mean? They might have passed each other in Bempton and said hello, but they're not friends. So we've got two similar sightings years apart and probably a quarter of a mile apart of something similar. To me, it's fascinating. It's and so diverse, Paul.
Yeah.
It's the amount of, you know, the multi-phenomena area, it's the amount of stuff that's there. Even these strange electrical readings and the strange anomalies with the tri-field meter that shouldn't be occurring.
Mm.
And the sound is quite unique as well. I've been up there with numerous people over years and heard a very, very high-pitched sound that's uncomfortable in your ears.
Yeah.
And there might be two or three of you can hear it, and one of you in group can't.
Mm.
You know, the American guy that went up there a few months ago, he encountered it in the early hours walking back to Thornwick Bay. Just his right ear, literally just stepped, walking along the cliff tops, took a step, this high-pitched sound's in his ear. Stepped back, it's gone.
Yeah.
Step forward, it's there. Step forward again, it's gone. Step back, it's there. What is it we're dealing with? What, is it directed at him, or is it just a beam of some kind of energy that he's just been unfortunate enough to walk past?
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
Mm.
Because it's that unassertive, it's that sort of uninteresting a place. You, like you've just said, it's beautiful in the daytime. It's got, you know, you've got the seabird colony.
Mm.
But it's pretty bland. You've got the North Sea on your right or your left, depending on which direction you're walking. So obviously that's nice to look at, but you've only got fields on other side, and it's green. It's just green. You're not looking at masses of forest and woodland. It's pretty bland. So why is it happening in these places? You know, you've got extensive cave systems below the cliffs as well.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about the remoteness, we know that the North Yorkshire Moors, the forests are absolutely devoid of footfall most of the time.
Yeah.
But you get a lot of holiday makers between Bridlington, Scarborough, Whitby, you know. So, but along the coastline, there's only little coves that are accessible.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Bridlington Beach, you've got Bridlington Bay, should we say, and South Beach. But then when you get towards Sowerby, you can go park up at Sowerby and walk down, and you've got a little beach there, and then you've got nothing unless a low tide and you can walk round, but it's pretty secluded until you get to Danes Dyke, and then you can't get round from Danes Dyke to Flamborough. You know, anything could be down there because you can't walk it, and then you could probably say, well, how come if you can't walk it, someone else can't?
Mm.
I don't know, but there's places and coves that never get footfall. That's what I'm saying, never. And caves that are just totally inaccessible. Hundreds and hundreds of caves all the way up and down the coast. And where we run out of rock, steep rock formations, we run into craggy ravines and bits of cliff that are thick with gorse and brambles and all sorts of vegetation. And when you're looking at elevations that rise up to, you know, from 100 foot to 300 foot, and it's on a steep slope,
yeah,
there's not many humans can traverse that kind of ground. I don't. I mean, to be honest with you, I can feel my age because every time I get up around Speighton, Paul, because it's a very steep climb going up.
Yeah.
I used to be able to go straight up it, kind of looking at people and thinking, oh, I bet they're tired. But I'm feeling it myself now.
Yeah.
It's hard work.
Mm.
So, yeah, crazy place.
Yeah. I think that's the thing often, Paul, that people have this misconception. They think, oh, it's the coast. And I think a lot of people presume, well, there must be beaches everywhere. But even where we were, you know, looking down onto those, that wonderful kind of fork that sort of reaches out in towards the North Sea, where you've got the sea's carved a hole through it. And it's an incredible thing to see. There's no way you can walk around there at all.
You can't walk around even at low tide, and you can't get down either. You can see little sloping bits and you think, I could get down. And the rock anglers, they'll tell you, so looking at them stones, them rocks are below. When they've been round in inflatables and things, because obviously you could access it.
Yeah,
you'd have to pick your tide because it's there's more. Oh, just before we get to that, there's more shipwrecks off Flamborough Head than anywhere else in the UK.
Mm.
The sea is absolutely violent. It's hostile.
Yeah,
you know, different riptides. But what he's saying is, when you look at from above, when you're looking at those rocks, and they look about as big as washing up bowls, should we say, for want of a better word, they're as big as lorries.
Yeah,
that's how deep you are. When you look at the seabirds flying below, they only look like specks.
Yeah,
you know, you don't get a true idea of the perspective. I mean, and we're not here. We're not in anywhere that's anywhere near as breathtaking and panoramic as the mountains in America and the canyons and things. So God knows what it must be like in them places as regards the remoteness and getting out somewhere where there's just nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that when you look at it and look at that, I mean, it was a lovely evening when we were there, Paul. It was quite nice. Wasn't particularly windy, but the sea was still ferociously smashing into the cliff walls. And you would think, I wouldn't like to be in that.
We look at, you know, sometimes in winter when we're up there and you see lights at boats out there, it genuinely would frighten me to death.
Yeah.
I've got a friend who's got a trawler in Arbor, Tom Quinn, and he's often said to me, come out with us, Paul. you'll enjoy it. And I've just openly said, no, I know I would be frightened. And there's no other word for it. I would be frightened. Years ago, you know, I know we're jumping from the paranormal here, Paul, but there was a speedboat in Bridlington Harbour that used to take people out. And eldest daughter Sarah asked me, she said, oh, can we go on it, Dad? So I said, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I got on this speedboat, swear to you. Before we left Harbour, I knew I wanted to be back in Harbour. You know, you kind of overread all sorts of situations. It were quite choppy. The boat were leaving the water and bang, going down onto water and slightly tipping to one side and things. And I'm thinking, if this thing turns over, nobody's got a life jacket on.
Yeah.
We've all got heavy clothes because it's back end of summer and it's quite a cold day. Mm. And that's all I could think.
Yes.
not very optimistic, am I? But, you know, it were frightening.
Yeah.
But walking around forests, woodlands, going up into remote places, that's kind of handle. I don't mind.
It's
weird, isn't it?
It is. I've been fortunate enough to go out sailing in the Mediterranean, Paul, and that's pretty calm. But those kind of thoughts still come through my head because I'm not the best swimmer, and I'm thinking, well, if we go down here, I don't know what we're going to do. You know what I mean?
I know what I'd be doing. It'd be lights out for Paul. If I wouldn't have to be far offshore either. I think I could probably do 1 hour at Baths.
No, very true. Obviously, you're just about to do the fourth volume of Truth Proof, Paul. So is this a very similar kind of feel to how the other books? Because often, as you've touched on earlier, I think some people once again make the misconception this is all about you. And it isn't. You're the conduit for collecting these stories that, as you've developed your reputation and the books have grown in popularity and your appearances on other shows, both here and in America, have gained you some interest from all over the world. It's one of those things that I've always been struck by your work, Paul, is that it's not all about, well, most of it isn't about you. It's about the people that have come forward to speak with you.
Yeah, it is. At least 98% of the inputs, you know, obviously I've written them. I get some good help off Don Lodge, you know, because my sort of punctuation and spelling's not the best in the world, and Amanda Eames. But, you know, all the content, everything that's written inside them's come out of my head, but it's only what people have told me.
Yeah.
You know, and usually, in most instances, not all instances, there's a name, an actual real name to the account, because that's always good. I mean, if you can't and you believe what you're being told, then I don't mind changing name for sort of witness confidentiality.
Mm.
But the bulk of the Truth Proof books are other people's accounts. And I really pride myself on doing research that can pack around somebody's story. You know, I don't know. We'll jump right back to when I weren't in the area. I'd have only been a young lad, like 1967, when there were a lot of UFO activity. But then I'll go into an archive and I'll find more information of unusual things. You don't have to make it up. It's there. It's just that the researchers of the day never found these things in the first place. But they're not looking for the big cat sightings. They're not looking for the strange anomalies of, a flock of sheep disappearing on the walls. All right, there could have been some sheep rustling, but when you find something that says unusual, somebody's that's left a report in a newspaper or got to you and said, you know, my dad were working at so-and-so in 1969 or 1970, and while he were there, he saw some really unusual lights, blah, blah, and you go in an archive, you've got a date, and then you find that sheep disappeared at the same date. You know, these are only rough analogies, but that's the kind of thing. I look for other things to pack round other people's sightings. It doesn't mean that it's connected, but it's so, so interesting. You know, I was looking at 1947. When you're looking through archives, if you find a little bit of information and it's not relating to what you're actually researching at the time, I make a note of it.
Yeah.
And I noted that 1947, I don't know if I've got the information in front of me now, and I'll work on it. I'll do more. So there's a little bit more semblance to it. But you know, first of all, we've got one of the most extreme winters that in 1947. Then on the 15th of March, and I do have a bit of paper for once in front of me with this, there were mystery flares seen off Bridlington at 4:30 a.m.
Oh.
And I'm always going on about these mystery flares because...
Yeah.
Obviously, it is a mystery because if you launch the lifeboat and you get the helicopter up looking for boats and ships in distress and aircraft in distress, and nothing's found, and you just put false alarm with good intent,
yep.
And it's not somebody on beach setting a flare off. These are out at sea, so there's something's responsible. So first of all, we've got mystery flares. That's all kind of a trigger.
Yeah.
And then on the same day, they find a woman's body floating in the water, and they've no explanation. I went through archive to see what the general opinion was, and we know we're going back to 1947. We know we're never going to find an answer.
Hmm.
Do you know? Then you know, 4 days later, bullocks found dead at the bottom of Selwick's Bay. You know, cattle.
Yeah.
You know, it could have fell.
Yeah.
You know, a few miles further up the coast, they find another one. And then we've got. Then as we move in, we've got like 82 hours of sunshine in 7 days. We've got extreme weather conditions. And in August, a 17-year-old girl vanished whilst paddling. Just paddling. You know, apparently they were watching her from the shore, you know, on the beach, and this girl vanished.
Yeah.
Lots of things. Two men vanished so she vanished on the 12th. Two men vanished in Filey on the 17th. Never found again.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The 22nd, two men found floating in Bridlington Bay. Not them.
Yeah.
Do you know, it's weird. You know, obviously there's lots more work to do with 1947.
Mm.
So I like to go into a little bit more detail, but you find all these quirky anomalies. You know, I'm looking at the month of June now.
Yeah.
The amount of aircraft that's gone down in June.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. It's and that is the word for it. And I could just give you two for example, but it doesn't mean there's a paranormal aspect to it. But it just I find it fascinating that last year on June the 15th, tragedy I know, but the Sea Eagle crashed off Flamborough Head.
Yeah,
you know, 1998, June the 15th, tornado crashes off Flamborough Head.
Mm.
You know, June the 8th, they find a man in the water off Flamborough Head. Interestingly, found by the crew of the Betty, which were Tom Quinn, my friend.
Yeah.
And it was 6 miles off. Shouldn't have been there. One at crew said, I've just seen a man in water, which they just thought, how could he be? Do you know what you're talking about, you know?
Yes.
But they took his word for it and they went towards him and they found a man still alive. He died on board boat.
Mm.
But he'd been, that was June the 8th, 1983, but he'd been in a Cessna.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have been over at sea. I've sent an email to the flying club where he was from. I've had no response.
Mm.
I've got the flight report from it, and it's a complete mystery why he ended up over at sea.
Yeah.
Once again, we can't say that any of these things are not anything more than a tragic accident.
Mm.
But there's another three or four aircraft that have gone down all in June. Various years. Do you know, it's so interesting.
Yeah.
And I'll be putting that together to probably do a presentation at Outer Limits Conference.
Yeah.
Because this is what I like about some of the research, that I'm not adding things just to strengthen my argument.
Mm.
But June the 15th, 2017, I did a presentation at Outer Limits Conference in 2018, I think it was. And but part of the presentation was that a triangular formation appeared in a pink pea crop at Bempton.
Yeah.
But it was June the 15th. The date crops up, do you see?
Yeah.
Or the month of June crops up. Now, if I had just said that today, and the people would automatically think, nah, he's just saying things about June.
Yeah.
Well, I said it years ago. You know, it's actually there. It's filmed on a presentation. I haven't waited till now to start adding it to strange, quirky anomalies with aircraft. You know, but there's lots and lots of information packed around that month. So we are identifying a month up there as well, which is a month that is active, should we say?
Yeah, and I think often, Paul, when it comes to any kind of phenomenon, whether you're looking at strange lights in the sky or you're hunting ghosts or you're looking for cryptids, often people can be so focused on that particular thing that they're searching for that that they miss weird things like this. Like you say, animals disappearing or being found dead in strange places, people disappearing, strange bodies washing up who don't bear any resemblance to the other people who are missing, planes going down, strange things being sighted, people seeing lights, flares out at sea.
You're spot on. Who's going to put that together?
Yeah.
Who's thinking to themselves, hold on a minute, could there be a connection here? And then when you start looking over year after year, decade after decade, and you realise that something strange has happened. I've spoke about this one before. I think it was 2006 on Short Lane. It seems to throw up a lot of big cat sightings and strange anomalies. It's just an indistinct lane, probably a mile long, just a small edge road for a quarter of a mile and then fields either side of it. But you get big cat sightings on Short Lane. People talk about driving along it. It's a single track road with pull-ins, but you're driving along it and they say a panther ran across the road in front of me.
Yeah.
And they're not just saying it to me, by the way. These are reports in the archives.
Yeah.
Why Short Lane? Hunt for the deer butcherers on Short Lane. And you read the write-up and it'll say, you know, they're looking for some people that have shot or killed some deer in unusual circumstances, and they think they're poachers. But then at the end of the article, they say, however, no meat was taken. It was paired off the bone in an unusual manner. And I'd love to have seen photographs.
Yeah.
But then you find out that Short Lane's got these cat sightings. It has UFO sightings. You know, some young guys, I think we pinned it down to 2006. I know I've written about it probably in Truth Proof 2. A lad from Bempton and his friends, and I think it was his first car. So you know how you get when you're late teens and you've got your wheels and you've got your freedom, and they're driving around Bridlington. Probably not. I don't mean under influence of drink or drugs. They're just young lads just having a cruise round in the car kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they decide to come back via Bempton Lane and go on to Short Lane, back home to Bempton, to their home. And someone tells me there were three in car. I don't think there were four in car, but I could be wrong. As they're driving along Short Lane, something just flies at low level, and we're talking just car roof level, straight across the road in front of them.
Yeah.
So he likened it to a wasp, but big. And it was that what the moment. You know what I mean? And we'll not swear, but it was one of them moments, and they slowed the car down, and then it came back.
Oh.
Like zigzag and came back. And and they saw it, and it slowly descended, and they said it looked like silver and blue panels that looked like they were turning.
Yeah.
Revolving. And just as it touched the floor, or if it didn't touch the floor, it were inches off it, and it was circular, this object, like as wide as road, it literally just sped away at great speed. So that's another weird one from Short Lane. And I said, what did you do? He says, I floored the car and we went home.
Yes.
You know, and I got speak. I actually went to a farm to speak about a big cat sighting. And I were uninvited, but I mean, I went broad daylight, and I intended either speaking to them if they were in farmyard or knocking on the door, and this guy were outside farmyard, in the farmyard, and I asked him if they'd had any reports of cats, because there were things being seen around that time, and he said, no, but I've seen a UFO. And of course, then I were all ears. I said, can I record you? And I got a little Olympus recorder, and I recorded him telling me this story. So, yeah, so interesting, you know, and that's basically, you know, what it's like. It's like speaking to that guy yesterday. I think I'm pretty limited what I'm going to get from this man, although he does sound really interesting. But as we get for the benefit of the documentary Wolflands, it's difficult. We can discuss it. I could discuss it with Chris Wright, who first put me onto the story, and we could do a little cameo of discussing what he's seen. But there's nothing better than getting the witness, even if he's got his back to camera, saying, you know, there's nights I stand out here looking into this forest, and it's not happened often, but, you know, two or three times in all years I've lived here, but you would swear there were a pride of lions in the forest. I find it a fascinating thing to say, you know?
Yeah.
There'll be more. There's more. We're off. Myself and Les Drake are off next week, fingers crossed, up past Whitby to Sands End to film someone that's had a cryptid-type experience. So we'll be filming that guy. He's going to go on film for us. You know, we can't go on forever. It's not sort of filling up and thinking, God, when you're going to stop. We realized that we probably wanted a little 5 to 8 minute segment to round off the film, and this account, what this guy's got, is going to do it. And all everything else is just in place. We're just polishing it. All the linking pieces are done. You know, the narration's done. We've been in the record. My daughter's got a little recording studio, so we've been in there, done all linking pieces from story to story, and all the visuals that fit between the words or around the words. So I'm kind of confident that when Wolflands is done, it does sound like a boast, doesn't it? But I think it's going to be best scripted documentary to come out of this country. I really do.
Yeah. I must admit, because I've, like, as I said earlier, Paul, I've spent a lot of time in this area now, the last 15 months. Oddly, and you know, it's just how it's fallen for me. And I can imagine that if something odd is living somewhere out there, then, as you say, there's other than occasional tourists, and I remember driving through there last summer on our way up to Northumberland, and it was, you could see the certain parking areas and it was rammed. But as far as the eye could see, there might be an old farmhouse somewhere, and that'd be it. For miles and miles and miles, Paul, and it was beautiful, and all the heather was out, all blooming purple. It was gorgeous, absolutely stunning. And it's, and I jokingly turned to my partner and said, well, if this is anything, it's werewolf country. We both started laughing, you know, because it's so remote, regardless of these tourists. You know, when it gets to like 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, any day of the year, Paul, there's no bugger there.
That's right. Well, you know, as the nights are drawing in now, last night, for example, myself and Bob Brown went up onto Cliff Tops, and we sort of took a right, and we were where we were with you two.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that Sasha Christie and Paula Green and Paula's friend, I think they're called a Lynn, and a guy called Darren Haynes.
Yeah.
Lovely people, to be honest. And they were at other end up past old RAF base. We met up with them later, but apart from people looking for unexplained phenomena, let's put it that way, there were nobody there.
Yeah.
You know, and, what a word to say, looking for unexplained phenomena, because it finds you.
Yes.
I were quite amazed when those lights appeared last night, because myself and Bob, you know, we're very good friends, and we spend a lot of time up there, and we'll say things to each other, you know, like, it's got to break this sooner or later. Something's got to happen. I mean, I've written these books and talked about all people's accounts, and here I am coming up here, and we've been up here for months and months and nothing.
Yeah.
And then you go up and there's three or four other people there, and bang, it's there, it's in your face. It happened with Chris Turner. Chris came up, and Jerry and Mark Farnell, and that night were very active. But, you know, we might go another 2 or 3 months. I will go tonight on the strength of, I have noted, you know, the sort of, the research, if you can call it research, sort of points to the fact that when things are happening,
yeah,
it seems to bubble for a few days.
Yeah.
So we shall keep sort of plugging away at it. I mean, as your podcast's name, Mysteries and Monsters, you know, I never really ever thought that I'd be looking into cryptids. You know, to me, it's a ridiculous subject. Mm. Absolutely. The thought that something akin to a werewolf could actually be out there, it's terrifying, but B, it's just so implausible,
yeah,
or improbable, but I have to pinch myself.
Yeah.
These people don't know each other. None of them know each other. And for the ones that I deal with, because there are some that I won't even entertain.
Yes.
I'm dealing with pretty sane individuals.
Mm.
You know, mm. I mean, the guys from Rotherham in the forest, yes, up in North Yorkshire. After he'd seen it, both of them were troubled, both, yeah, of them. But Steve in particular, he said he stopped talking to his wife, his kids. When I said stop talking, I don't mean he fell out with them. I mean that, you know, normally, you know, when somebody's got a mood change, and,
yeah,
and he said my wife thought I was having an affair. He said I could see this thing all the time.
Yeah.
Said I just could not get it, the image of it out of my mind. They didn't go there looking for this. They went there wild camping.
Yeah.
Done for years and years and years as friends, you know. I don't know what age of them, 50s, two of them are 50s, and other one who's not gone on films in late 40s.
Yeah.
And they'd never experienced anything like this. Never. It was just a complete shock to their system to think that anything like that could actually exist and to see it with their own eyes. And, you know, he said some things to me which are priceless. Like, he said, I just didn't know I had that much fear inside me.
Yeah.
I just didn't know if somebody had I said, I just wanted it to end. I just wanted it to be over. I was so frightened that I didn't care how it ended. I just needed it to stop. And they were only looking at him.
Yeah.
But the actual fear that it projected onto him, just absolutely overwhelming. And I think that's maybe what these things want, you know.
Mm.
From my experience, because the people that I've spoke to about this are experiencing extreme fear, but they're not experiencing being attacked.
Yeah.
And if we're talking about some apex predator that's carnivorous, then we're fair game, aren't we?
Yeah, of course.
We don't run very fast, and in grand scheme of things, if you're facing something as big as a bear, you're not gonna be able to stand up to it. So why are we not being consumed?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we might be in some instances. I'm not saying that that's never happened, but the people I've spoken to obviously have lived to tell the tale. But what they have experienced is incredible fear. They've experienced what I call the lower silence.
Yeah.
You know, the when everything just changes, the atmosphere changes. Mm. You know, one of our witnesses for Wolflands, Gaz, he said it was like somebody had just pressed pause.
Yeah.
He said everything just stopped. He says, no, I can no longer hear at sea. Can't hear seabirds. He said, and suddenly there's like a blanket of fears just dropped over me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't sum that kind of analogy up better or understand what's happening. Is it an atmospheric change because we've, I don't mean entered some other kind of dimension, but there's some friction of realities sort of together.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a scientist. I mean, I'm probably talking complete rubbish, but I can't understand. There's definitely something, a reality changing mechanism occurring within these areas, within the time or at the time of the experience. The experience is probably just an artifact of the environment that we've been placed into, Paul.
Yeah.
Now, whether we're entering that environment or whether that environment in these thin areas has just infiltrated our own, and we're getting a little glimpse of another world, maybe, or the other altered reality is able to just have a little glimpse at ours.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they stand staring. Maybe that's why they're looking. Maybe these things are in as much disbelief about what they're seeing as what we are.
Absolutely. I've often thought that when people have these kind of encounters, Paul, because it is very interesting, like you say, that if we are to take these people on their word and their experience, and this applies to other strange cryptids, especially in this particular area, Paul, as obviously since I've been doing this show, I've learned so much more about barghasts and things like that, and the fact that they still be reported in that area, even up until I think the most recent report I've seen is from the 90s. Of somebody claiming to have seen a bar guest. So for me, that's the very similar kind of thing as we have that's allegedly going on in the States with Dogman, Paul.
That
these people are chased out, followed, whatever. But as you say, these things clearly can catch them. You know, we're talking about people are explaining and claiming to have seen 7-8 foot tall creatures that they can't comprehend, that exudes power, that instills a sense of deep fear in these people. There's no way you could get away from something like that at all. It could quite easily capture you and consume you if you wish to. So that's the other really interesting aspect of all this is, why isn't it attacking people? What's stopping it? Where is the cutoff point that it's just this kind of staring competition or this...
Yeah, well, do you know, I mean, I'm not particularly religious, but there might be... If we use a religion as an aspect of, there might be some sort of religious theme to these things, as in they might not be able to.
Yeah.
And I don't mean because of God. I mean, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I've heard people say that they've prayed and it's gone. Do you know, why not sing a song and it goes? But it's something to do with praying and to God and asking for help from God, and these things have disappeared or moved away. Because we know that in many instances, they seem to be able to predict our thoughts or know what we're going to do.
Yep.
You know, with the Dogman Encounters type scenarios and the Bigfoot, when the hunter or they sort of go for a gun, they get a feeling that this thing's saying, don't.
Mm.
Don't. So it's I think what I'm trying to get at is there's an added intelligence to these things that you're not going to get with normal animals that we would encounter. Yeah. Be it in this country or another country. If you went to Africa and you were on plains of Africa and you encountered a pride of lions, we know that unfortunately the outcome's not going to be good.
No.
But you encounter something that sounds like it's as equally ferocious, but nothing happens.
Yeah.
Yet we hear that these things eating deer. So obviously they distinguish the difference between us and deer. Why?
Yeah.
I know I'm asking that question. Somebody might know it. I don't know it.
Hmm.
And we're not, all we seem to do, myself, so I'm no different, we just go around in circles asking these questions. I suppose we've got to keep questioning things. Then you've got the other people that know. They'll tell you what it is. You know, yeah. I'll tell you this is, I'll tell you what they are, just switch off. You know?
Well, the thing they can't say over here, Paul, is it's people misidentifying bears, isn't it? Because well, that's the usual thing.
And I'll tell you what's interesting. One of the spots that we visit up there, some of the farmers in the area have had walkers. I'm not going to try and describe every type of person that had come up to them, but say they're working in a field, they'll have had some hikers walk up to them.
Yes.
They think they've just seen a bear. They think they've just seen a large animal in the forest. You know, and that's happened on more than one occasion. Hence, there's like a rumour up there, like a tale up there that in one of the ravines, there's a bear living in one of the ravines. Now, we know there isn't. Well, I can't categorically say it, but it's gone on for decades. But what I think what's been seen is what we're writing about, what we're documenting for Wolflands. And it's not a bear.
Yeah.
And I don't actually think it's there all the time. I do believe it's something that lives between worlds. I do not think it's solid flesh, blood and bone breeding population of these things 24/7, year after year, over hundreds of years.
Yeah.
But I'll not set that in stone. I could be wrong. And I hope somebody comes to me and gives me a little bit of proof that says, Paul, you're wrong. And I don't mind holding my hands up and saying, yeah, you've hit it on head. I just can't understand it. It's like the UFO aspect of things when you know you get the skeptic stroke debunker and he says, well, they can't possibly travel here, you know, the light years away, and they work it all out and how much speed they'd have to be traveling at, and it's all impossible. Well, I'm sorry, but I don't even want to listen to that argument because it's already here. And that's not me being disrespectful to people, but it's clearly, if we're getting hundreds and hundreds of people, thousands from all over the world reporting cryptid sightings, UFO sightings, it's here. It's real. We've just got to try and understand what is the real.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and maybe we need another, and it won't come from me because I'm not intelligent enough, but maybe we need another branch of science to look into, I don't know, just start looking in some different directions, lift some different stones up, because wherever we've been looking for the answers in the past hasn't found us them, has it?
Yeah. But I was going to ask you, Paul, in regards to Wolflands and the people you've spoken to, I know you were saying there that, you know, we're having this kind of fear installed and people aren't really, you know, being attacked or anything. Is there any other physical kind of proof? Because occasionally you'll hear stories of people, especially certain cryptids in the US, with Sasquatch and Dogman and things. There are occasions where things get scratched or there's damage to trees and things like that. Have any of the witnesses encountered any kind of secondary incident in regards to things like that? Or is it just purely these sightings and scares?
A physicality to
yes.
them.
Yes.
Well, jump into the guys that were from Rotherham, who I've just spoke about earlier. They did say, let me talk about these self-illuminating eyes as well. In the pitch black, is not something you'd attribute to any animal that I know about. We know we've got bioluminescence in the oceans, but these things have got self-illuminating eyes. That's what these guys saw. However, jumping back to them, when they were watching it, when it appeared, and it just appeared in the darkness, and the member that hasn't gone on film, the witness that hasn't gone on film, they've told me that he knew it were there long before, and they were telling him, yeah. I don't like it, we've got to go, something's watching us. He says, and we can't understand why he was saying all this. It weren't like him.
Mm.
But the physical aspect of it, when it stood up, because it were... We think it might have been on all fours or crouched at first, and it eventually stood up when Jim ran at it to shoo it away, because the guy who hadn't gone on film was very, very frightened.
Yeah.
And when it's about 3 foot off ground and he's looking at these eyes, he thinks it's some animal that he doesn't recognise, and he realised they couldn't get out of the forest. It had took them an hour and a half to get in. It was pitch black, and they just wouldn't have got out. It's in a ravine. But right, jumping to it, he said when it stood up and it were looking at them, they thought it were growling at them.
Yeah.
And after a while, they realised it weren't. It was its breathing.
Mm.
It was, they could hear it breathing.
Yeah.
It's, you know, almost, well, like a big beast.
Yeah.
So there is a physical to these things. And speaking to an American Indian, Larry Sespuch, who has a lot of knowledge on the Skinwalker, and if anybody wants to have a look at him on YouTube, you'll find he's kind of really respected guy. He's trying to keep all the traditions of their culture together, goes to schools talking and, you know, and sort of talks about his ancestors. But Larry said that he lives near Skinwalker. He says these things live between worlds.
Yeah.
And he said, and when they are here, you know, they could be touched. They are a living, breathing, flesh and blood thing. But that is their ability to move between worlds. He says, and if you go into these places with good intent, nothing will happen to you. I'm not saying he's right, but you know, his analogy of living between worlds. I don't mean, oh, Larry said it, so I believe it. But that's kind of where I'm at with it, because when I look at these things that are seen, listen to the stories of these things that are seen on the cliff tops, Paul.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine where they'd hide.
Yeah.
Where they'd reside. I know I've said that these cliffs are 45 degrees. Well, they're vertical, but then they run to 45 degrees and they range from 80, 100, 200 foot, and it's all thick gauze and brambles. But, you know, in winter time. Where are you going to go? Yeah. What are you going to eat? You're way between 250 and 500 pound. You're going to want to pack away quite a lot of food.
Mm.
And, you know, if you were in cliffs below, these cliffs that nobody gets to because they're inaccessible, but you're somehow superhuman, could leap all over the place and get to them. You've still got to eat.
Yeah.
You've still got to stay warm, relatively warm.
Yeah.
You know, a sea cave, it's going to be a pretty miserable place to live. I mean, I know I'm saying all this and I've no idea, but I've got people reporting these things on cliff tops. What I'm getting at is I don't know where they go. So that doesn't mean I don't believe what they're telling me, but I believe we're dealing with something other or more than purely physical. And it has all attributes, doesn't it, to be more than physical?
Yeah.
It lets you know it's there before you even see it. You know the environmental change, the self-illuminating eyes, the fact that it seems to perceive what you're going to do before you do it.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to these things than a normal flesh, blood and bone animal.
Yeah. Now, it's perplexing, and I suppose that's half the excitement about it, Paul, because it is so strange. And as I've said, you've got to take these people on their word. And
well, not everyone's going to tell the truth, Paul. You know what I mean?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And, you know, but I don't mean that I get it right every time.
Yeah.
I've pulled the story out of the latest book because I've realised that it's not right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not going to start an argument with anybody by saying, oh, but I've just not in it no more anyway.
Mm.
And so, you know, not everything that you're told is sort of set in stone and 100% real. But, you know, when you read emotion on people's faces,
and they're
crying when they come out at forest, they're that relieved. And they say, like, this has just been like a sword hanging over my head. And I feel like I've actually moved forward by doing this.
Yeah.
You know, and the gamekeeper in the forest up there, 2002, all the underlying experiences just before he saw the cryptid, walking back to the farmhouse and the sphere of light just exploding outside of his leg and going up into the sky.
Mm.
You know, and he actually thought, being an ex-Marine, he thought he'd tripped a tripwire flare.
Yeah.
He says, and I just got my cousin, who were with me, my nephew, and dropped him to the floor, and we just stayed there waiting for squaddies to come out.
Yeah, yeah.
He says it didn't light sky up like it should have done. Mm. Next day I went to look for magnesium burns. Nothing.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, they're hearing babies crying in forest, him and the other gamekeeper.
Mm.
And, you know, having we realise that's kind of Bigfoot-type attributes or things that has reported. He said, but you went to where you'd heard it, and there's nothing.
Yeah.
And it's a bit further into the forest. Mm. And for your experts who sit there saying, well, it may be this or that, these blokes live and work in forest. They're more used to hearing and seeing what's actually out there than I am.
Yeah.
Or your armchair expert.
Mm.
So when they're telling you it's unusual, take it to the bank. Do you know what I mean? When you've got a guy in the forest who I spoke to the other day, who lives in the forest in a cottage, and tells you that there's been a few occasions when he's heard what sound like a pride of lions in the forest.
Yeah.
You could either is lying.
Yeah.
And he don't want to go on film, so it's not for sensationalism.
Yeah.
Or he's hearing something that's a lot more unusual than what he's been used to hearing over the years that he's lived in that property.
Yeah.
So there's something there, you know?
I find it fascinating regardless, like you say, because something's going on. What it is, as you say, we can theorise about it. We can go round and round trying to put his finger on exactly what we think it might be. But at the end of the day, I think the only way to keep investigating it and digging new stuff up is that's what's going to keep us hopefully moving forwards in regards to this.
Well, you know, as regards jumping from cryptids to these lights, these unusual lights, we're spending more and more money on equipment, and I've got that little psionics camera with me last night, and I managed to film them. I've got some quite good footage of these lights, and they're out over Filey Bay, and I haven't even had time to download the footage yet, but it's not blurry footage on a black background like a light on black velvet. This is good footage. You can see that they're clearly above the sea.
Yeah.
You can actually see a couple of fighter jets behind them. Now, it's hard to see because they could be 5 miles behind them, or they could be in a similar line.
Mm.
But whatever these lights are, they're not pulsing. They're about massive compared to the lights from the fighter jets.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge. Like comparing a mini car to a double-decker bus.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's hard to say what they are. The thermal camera, they didn't throw out an heat signature. So what I'm saying is we'll just keep gathering eventually, and the cryptid researchers, they'll just keep gathering the information. I mean, obviously the trail cams, the gifting, everything else that people's doing, it doesn't seem to be paying off.
Hmm.
So there's got to be some element of this research that we've not thought about. Well, it's got to be. We've not thought about yet. But like some kind of trigger point where we will get, you know, for a reaction, we're going to get an action.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is. I haven't got an answer, but maybe we should be looking at the genuine experiencers who seem to see these things on a regular basis, and looking at what attributes these people have got that we haven't got.
Yeah.
Do they think, everybody thinks different, but do they think vastly different to us? Have they got any impairments? Is there something? Because there's something definitely connects with these things with certain individuals more than others.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There is often that kind of theory, Paul, that these things occur to certain people in certain situations, regardless of what kind of phenomenon. And I've often had this kind of discussion in regards to the paranormal, why if you have 30 people walking through an alleged haunted house, one person sees something. Why don't the other 29? Why is that one person special?
Good point. And maybe you've got to have complete belief, unadulterated belief. I don't mean blind, stupid belief, but, you know, a good dose of belief. If you've seen something, once you've seen it, you know, they say the phenomena looks back at you.
Yeah.
You know, the deeper you look into the abyss, the more it looks back at you. And But if you've seen it, if you've seen something totally unbelievable, totally that just shouldn't exist, like for instance, Night People and them beings that I saw as a child.
Yep.
I don't need anybody to tell me what it is now.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I'm a know-all. What I'm meaning is, but I've seen them. I know that anything that can appear in your bedroom when your parents are in bed next door.
Yep.
And these things are there. They're not opening front door and appearing. They can appear and look physically, even if they were just holographic. I don't know what they were.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, let's stay with Night People for a minute, just to answer somebody said in one of comments or reviews. They'd read the book, they liked it, but they think that the experiences I had as a child and as a young adult, 94 or youngish adult, 93 to 98, could be explained by what do they call it, lucid dreaming and yeah. That kind of. Well, I hope that would explain the procedures that I saw them doing and the pain that I felt, and then waking up with holes in my arm and holes in my back.
Yeah,
is that a common effect of lucid dreaming?
Yeah,
because you know they came up with that explanation, but failed to address the fact that you've got medical records and you've got scars on your arms and scars on your back when you've woke up from the night before.
Yeah.
You know, and that's nothing to do with dreaming, you know. It's real. I think people maybe can sense my frustration.
Yes.
So I know no more than anyone else listening to this now.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people.
Mm.
I've got their accounts and I kind of get a feel for when somebody's telling me something genuine and when somebody's sort of leading me up garden path.
Yeah.
However, I haven't got the answers. I wish I had. We'll keep searching for them, Paul, you know, but I haven't got the answers.
Absolutely, and I look forward to the next opportunity I get to join you at some point, my friend.
Well, you will be welcome, you know that, and
yep.
we'll just keep chipping away. The new book, hopefully, 2 or 3 weeks, it will be out. Anybody interested in that book or the other books really should have a look on the truthproof.uk website, because we've set ourselves a little shop up on there now.
Yep.
I talk like I'm some authority of knowledge. It's Don Lodge who set me the shop up and he's helped me with the website. He puts the reports on as I get them.
Yep.
So I'm very fortunate to have the help of Don and so many people, Paul, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just about me, this. There's the people that come up onto them cliff tops. I mean, Bob Brown's 74-year-old, bless him.
Yep.
And he'll come up. If I knocked on his door at 12 at night and said, there's been some reports, do you want to come in? So give me 10 minutes.
Yeah.
He'd be there. It's pure dedication. You know, Steve Ashbridge, Andy Ramsden, Amanda Eames. There's not just myself. And the rock anglers.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of eyes and ears, you know, because once during October when the fishing season will start.
Yeah.
And these guys will be up on them cliff tops then, sat on the edges of those cliffs, trying to catch cod or whatever fish is out there. But my point is that they'll go 2 in the morning just before high tide or an hour before and let the fish, the tide coming in and fish it going out. They're there at prime times in between 1 and 3 in the morning, 1 and 4 in the morning. The times when the phenomena is most active, basically.
Yeah.
So I have a lot to thank for the people around me. I guess that's what I'm saying, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. So everybody, if they want to get hold of a copy of the book and your other previous books, including Night People and the first 3 volumes of Truth Proof, the website's the best place to go now, Paul, is it?
I would, yeah. The Amazon Kindle books are there on Amazon, obviously.
Yeah.
And so are the paperbacks. But basically, they're up for sale, and I think they're cheaper anyway on the Truth Proof website.
Yeah.
But if you're unsure, because I'm not in the business of just trying to sell books here. I want to tell people's accounts and convince people that there is a truth to what we're speaking about. That's my main role here.
Yeah.
But if you are unsure about whether thinking, oh, well, I don't know what this guy's about, go to Amazon and read reviews on books.
Yep.
Rather than let me tell you. That's the easiest way to do it, Paul, you know?
Yeah.
But basically, truthproof.uk, there's the YouTube channel as well, the Truth Proof live stream, and we have some brilliant guests on it most Thursdays.
Yeah.
And you've been on it yourself, Paul, and we hope to get you back again.
Anytime, yeah, I'd be delighted to rejoin. I always try and catch up with them. If I can't see them live, Paul, I'll always follow them next couple of days, and you've had some brilliant guests over the last 2 years. Not apart from myself.
Well, yeah. Oh, you were definitely the best we've ever had.
Thank you.
No, it's all good. It's all good, mate. So, yeah, I think we've just about summed everything up there, haven't we? And I hope I haven't bored people too much, and we'll do it another time.
No, you're very welcome. Thank you as always for your time, Paul. It's a pleasure to have you on Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Thank you.